Good morning, everybody. This is Robin Ayoub from the Localization Fireside Chat, and welcome to another conversation. With this recording, we are recording episode 222, I believe, if the count serves me correctly. If I'm off by one, don't shoot the messenger. You can just go back to the recording count and then adjust it if you want to. So this morning, a guest sent me an email, and there's one phrase in that email and in the subject line that really caught my eye, and I wanted to explore this a little further with my guest today. AI is moving fast, leaders are not. That came from today's guest, Kelly Monahan. Welcome to the show. And honestly, I could think a better way to frame this conversation. You know, think about it, like the industry that we work in, the localization industry, working across the border, cross borders, cross languages, cross time zones, with teams and talents that may never meet in person. Like, we probably don't meet each other in person. Occasionally we do in some small settings, small conferences, but not necessarily meeting the people that you work with. Many of us have been navigating the distributed workforce and work in general before the rest of the world even could name it. Think about it. If you have a project that you want to do in 20 languages, you're probably not flying to these 20 countries to achieve the project. You're probably working with these individuals remotely, most likely. And now AI is in the mix, reshaping everything from how we source talent, how we lead people who are doing the work, and look at completely different way than we worked before. Now AI is in the middle of all this. And we talk about it on this channel quite a bit, where AI gets involved, where human gets involved, what portion of the work AI needs to be involved in, and what portion of the work humans still need to be involved in. And as you heard me say this before, every one of those conversations has got an expiry date to it, because whatever statement we make today may not be relevant tomorrow as technology continue to progress and continue to evolve. So my guest today, she's leading a future work of research. She led future work of research at Deloitte to Meta, and founding the Upwork Research Institute, and now running Beyond the Desk. She's also a TEDx speaker published in Harvard Business Review and MIT Sloan. And her latest book, Essential, co-authored with Christy Smith, a national bestseller. And I just looked up Christy Smith's profile. Very interesting. I'd love to get her on the podcast as well. Kelly Monahan, welcome to the Localization Fireside Chat, or Dr. Kelly Monahan, apologize. And for the rest of the audience, welcome to the podcast. Welcome to the episode. Let's get into it. Kelly, welcome to the conversation.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to get into it today.
Same here. As we get going in this conversation, Dr. Monahan, if you don't mind, one question that everybody gets on this podcast, we keep it light initially, and then we get into the topic a little heavy. Okay. So the first one is the story question. What is your story? What got you here?
Yeah. You know, I will try to keep this as concise as possible, but you know, I know we were chatting beforehand. I'm originally from Rochester, New York, and those that know Rochester, New York know that the one brand that's associated with that is Kodak. And so during my formative years,
and
when
Xerox,
I was in middle school, what's that?
And Xerox. And
Xerox. Yes, Xerox, Bausch & Lomb, and Kodak. Yes, 100%. And, you know, it was during, you know, some formative years, middle school, junior high, where I was looking around and all of a sudden my class sizes kept shrinking and shrinking. And what was happening, I mean, I didn't know I was a kid, but Kodak was shedding 45,000 workers in Rochester over a course of a decade. And so I think at a young age, I saw this fear of job loss, of not being relevant. And the irony is, you know, Kodak invented the digital camera. And it wasn't that they didn't have the technical know-how, it was they didn't have the culture and leadership elements to actually capture that moment. And so, you know, I think that was a much more formative than I realized at the time that I can now articulate looking back. And so that led me to get into HR and figure out that's got to be the people side of the business. How do we make sure that people stay employed, that we get this moment right? And my very first assignment was reduction in workforce. So, you know, this is going back almost 20 years ago, and it was robotic process automation. I call it like baby AI at the time. And we realized it was a financial services company. We didn't need the 200 employees. RPA could do it. And so that was my very first exposure to the way that technology is going to disrupt work. And so since then, I have dedicated my career to studying the dynamics and intersection of leadership, labor markets, and AI, or relating sort of emerging technologies, in the hopes of being able to make sure we're not going to be able to have future-proof employment ever, but hopefully that we can begin to humanize that experience. No matter what happens with disruption, there's a pathway in terms of skilling, you know, career advancement, that sort of thing, that a lot of people, I think, know we should be doing right now, especially in this moment with AI that's becoming as disruptive, if not more, than RPA was. And yet so little attention is being faced on that. So that's what I've done. And as you mentioned, I've started research, first future of work research at Meta, Deloitte, Accenture, and really excited to be on my own now and helping advise. So I can be unfiltered and not represent a company anymore. So we can really say what needs to be said in this moment.
You know, you touch upon something very interesting. And anecdotally, when I started this conversation, I was working for a major corporation.
Yeah.
And the level of conversation, that's what the audience have been telling me, like, Robin, you've changed. I said, what do you mean I changed?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, yeah.
He said, oh, you know what? When you used to work for a large corporation, your podcasts were like, okay, we listened to them, we liked them, but your conversation was sort of measured, controlled, you know, you're trying to choose your word. And now that you don't work for a large corporation, the podcast is a lot more free. We feel like you sort of came out of your cocoon or something. And I didn't realize that, to be honest with you. I'm still the same, but subconsciously, apparently that had an effect on people. After I left, I lost.
Isn't that wild?
Isn't that crazy? Like, I did not intentionally.
It is. Yes. I intentionally left so I could write my next book and be able to, I think, say what needs to be said in the moment. But that is fascinating, just organically that came through. You know, everyone's talking about bringing your authentic self to work. I think the best way to do that is work for yourself.
Absolutely. You know, talk about being yourself as you work for yourself.
Yes, that's right.
So you started in media and marketing before pivoting to research.
Yeah.
Am I correct? And organizational behavior, you know, came later, I guess. What was the moment you realized a human side of work, you know, that needs to be a little bit more analyzed, where you needed to be kind of thing?
Yeah. So, you know, I got my business degree from Rossiter Institute of Technology. It was really excited. It was, you know, during a difficult time, you know, it was 07. So everyone, you know, was trying to find work. And I was drawn to math and analytics. And so there was a job that opened up that was media analytics and buying and planning and that sort of thing. And so allowed me to kind of flex an analytical muscle, but also, you know, get into the marketing side. I was originally going to study customer behavior. I was really thought that was the way. And I'll never forget, I was, you know, 21, 22, sitting, actually, they gave me an office. It was a really nice advertising company. And looking around and thinking, wow, this is wild, the dynamics of people working together. I mean, and this was almost like a script from the office. So the gentleman next to me had Tourette's. And so he had a really just flavorful personality and it was so dynamic and fun to work with, but drove his cube mate nuts next to him. My boss at the time spent most of his time playing solitaire. And it was just like, it was just something that you couldn't script. And I'm looking around, I'm thinking, is this really what work is all about? I went and got my business degree. And you think it's like this really like structured, predictable environment. And you realize the human behavior side of it is what fascinated me. And so that's where I spent about 2 years in that role and quickly pivoted to go focus on the HR side of it, because I wanted, as much as customers are interesting, I found the employee experience even more interesting at the time.
You know, to a large extent, you know, and I don't know if you agree with this, but I'd love to get your take on it, is that it's almost like there's a couple of two generations of workforce out there. There's the pre-AI and the post-AI, and we'll dig into it a little bit further, but I do feel, I do feel like in the era where we're in right now, we need to study this a little bit harder, because we've never been in this stage before. This is the first time humanity and corporations in general, maybe North America is a little bit more impacted than the rest of the world, because the rest of the world still have the nostalgia of, we can slow the progress of technology for human to catch up down the road kind of thing. But here we're talking about technology advancing at a faster rate than the management style or the management progression can adapt to that. What's your take on where we are right now in terms of us as a human workforce, and where is the human workforce going to be down the road? Would there be a human workforce down the road?
Yeah.
I guess that's a question that everybody's wrestling with. So.
Yeah. You know, it's so interesting. So, you know, as I mentioned, at the end of the day, I'm a trained researcher. And so I've been researching AI for about, I don't know, call it the last 15 years or so. And I find what's so fascinating, AI has been around since the 1950s. And so in some ways, if you were to talk to a peer technologist, they would actually tell you we are behind in terms of AI development, because what was promised in 1985, there's like this New York Times article that I posted recently, just because it mimics our time, around artificial intelligence is the most, you know, absurd corporate buzzword. It's being applied to everything. Another, you know, and these are people who started like MIT Media Lab, came out and said, you basically need human workers in 5 to 7 years. That was in the 70s. And so like, I think AI is very cyclical, not linear, and as we look through it. And so we've gone through these cycles of where there's been this hype and promise, and then we realize, oh, wait, it can't actually quite do that. The human work is actually much more complicated than we thought. And a perfect example of this I'll give you is Amazon. I worked with Amazon a few years ago, and they are very, like, it's not a secret that they are trying to do fully automated warehouses. And it is so hard to do. And we watched this out in the actual within an Amazon warehouse, where it's the minute fine motor skills and being able to read a context, you know, if something's wrong in real time and being able to correct that. And so I think that's the challenge of where we are, is I think there's still a lot of promise. We've made great bounds and leaps in the last 3 to 4 years of with generative AI in particular. However, I always caution everyone and say, you know, we've been through this. We saw it in the 50s, we saw it in the 70s, we saw it in the 80s, and now here we are today. Will there still be a human workforce? Absolutely. I do not foresee a future where humans are not needed.
You know, and I tend to agree with you. We always need a human to do certain things, but the jobs that they exist in the future are different than the jobs that exist today and the ones that have existed in the past. And funny you say AI started in the 50s. I recall when I went to my first year in college, I was doing computer science, early 80s.
Oh, cool. Okay.
Early 80s. And I was just playing around in the lab. I remember, how can I get this, you know, Amstrad, and I'm going to really date myself right now when I say Amstrad computers, to tell this computer, you know, to talk to me, right?
Yeah.
I was a bit of an introvert. That really washed off of me pretty quickly after that one.
Yeah.
And I wrote my first program. I remember, like, I was, you know, first year in trying to play around with this, what back then advanced technology, tried to tell the computer, like, if I tell you, you know, hello, you would answer this. If I ask you this question, you will answer the, you know. And I remember, you know, now I think about it, could that have been some sort of a form of engagement that I built into a program? Literally, it was doing my morning check, basically. How are you? How are you doing? And based on a specific canned answers, obviously back then, no vectoring databases or any of that stuff.
Yeah.
It was giving that reply back. And you're right. We go through these cycles of technologies, and it sounds like there's two layers to it. There's the programmatic layer, and there's the foundational structural layer, which is
what
drives it, the data centers, the computing facilities. What's your read on where we are right now, and what's the next phase look like before we get into the other stuff?
Yeah, I mean, it's great. And I love the example you gave too, because even like, so we think about like chatbots, you know, we have been chatting back and forth between computers actually for quite some time. So I think where we are today is we have made this incredible leap, you know, for those of your audience who knows the Turing test, which is essentially, can a human detect whether or not they're talking to a human or a computer? That has been like the holy grail of potentially leading us to artificial generalized intelligence. And we do know that that has been passed in many cases where we can no longer detect whether it's AI versus a human who's interacting with us. Now that's like in a field, like not in a field, but like in a lab setting. I think when you get out into the wild, we're seeing actually AI is adding a lot of complexity into workflows right now. So 1 + 1 used to always equal 2 when it was typical machine learning, when we knew like we were writing the parameters. With generative AI, the way that it works, it's meant to actually have a little bit more freedom, and it's meant to learn from itself. And with that comes about a 5 to 10% error rate that occurs throughout that. And so that's the area that I think leaders are trying to figure out. Ethan Mollack, who's a professor at UPenn, is, you know, I think brilliantly called this a jagged frontier, meaning AI is like unbelievable at certain things. As a business owner, I have been able to scale in fast time because of AI, stuff that I would never been able to do before. However, as a researcher, when I need to start doing much more complex tasks, we start to kind of go back into the plateau, right? Where it's no longer that great. And so I think that's where we are right now, is it's doing amazing job at some things where this is why you see the headlines of, oh my God, there's going to be this massive job loss. And then you start to get into it and you're like, ah, this is actually causing more time. There's more friction. This is actually not saving me money or time. And I think that's what we need to figure out. And I think where are we headed? It depends. That's why I think leadership is so important right now. It's the choices that we are making right now with this technology and people that will dictate the future. I see a very optimistic future where people, we've been talking about humans doing more creativity, innovation, unleashing human ingenuity. We have that possibility today. But I also see a dark future where leaders continue to face, you know, efficiency at all costs at the expense of people. We see that in the tech industry right now, mass layoffs that are occurring. We're seeing data centers go up and destroy rural communities. That is not an optimistic future for everyone. And so I think that's why leadership decisions right now are so important. We could go one of two ways.
Now, is that the gap that you mentioned? Like when you talk about AI is moving fast, so leaders are not, is that part of it? Or is it because I see, you know, the, like, this is just for me because I run I've been talking about AI for 2-3 years now, extensively about AI. I've been talking about AI for all my life, but extensively, I dedicated the past 2-3 years just to converse about AI and get to know a little bit of what's going on the management side, people side, technical side, etc. In fact, I run a Friday morning networking events at 9 o'clock in the morning. It's called the AI Exchange, where we got leaders from around the world. They get together and we do a bit of an exchange there. You're welcome to present to the group if you want to, if that's of an interest to you.
Oh, appreciate that. Oh, absolutely. That sounds fun.
So one of the things I'm seeing right now is leaders are jumping the gun on maybe driven by stock exchange, maybe driven by what's going on the S&P. I have no idea. But they're jumping the gun on the benefits that they can realize from AI before they actually realize those benefits.
That's right.
Typical case in point, in Canada, we have a company called Rogers Communication. It's one of our big telco here in the country. And they just announced a few weeks ago, they're laying off 12,500 people. That's 50% of their staff. And then when you go around and you ask like, okay, so how are you going to serve your existing market when you drastically remove that many staff out of your organization? Like, what is the backup plan here? Is everybody going to be a bot? I mean, I can send you the video after the call. It will make you laugh. There is a bot talking to a customer, and there is a bot supervisor supervising this bot. And the two bots get into an argument, and they start yelling at each other. And the customer still saying, hey, I'm here. What's going on?
My point is,
are we jumping the gun too fast on this thing?
So I think leaders have lost the plot of what this AI moment is all about. And I've got a new book coming out called Reclaim the Plot, How Leaders Rewrite the Story When AI Rewrites Work.
That's pretty cool.
Yes. Yeah. Because I think it's so important. And I've got, you know, it's basically storytelling through a fictional company. Because I've been in tech for the last 7 years and I've just seen what I'm calling in the book delirium, this delirium towards AI. Now, let me explain, before I beat up on leaders for a second, let me explain why I think we've lost the plot here about AI. One, most leaders in industries today are working in a low to no growth environment. That's just the reality. There is so many macroeconomic headwinds to get big business right that is really difficult. Two, as much as no one wants to talk about the pandemic anymore, the pandemic fundamentally shifted the way leadership happens. And to your point, distributed work, remote work, we've had like these really big fractures occur in our old school operating models. And so leaders are grappling with all of this. And oh, by the way, cash is a lot more expensive. Inflation is up almost everywhere, especially here to your point in North America. And so my profit margins are now being squeezed. And so is at such a time as this, the AI comes onto the scene and leaders are saying, this is fantastic. This is going to be the magic pill that's going to save us from this declining business. And the reality is it's not. And if anything, I think, you know, behind closed doors, when I talk to board members and CEOs, they're like, we've spent, you know, $80 million on AI this past year. I don't know what we're doing differently. I don't actually know what the ROI is on this. And so I think it's fascinating. I empathize with where leaders are going. However, I think that we're doing this at the expense of people and at the expense of long-term gains. And what I see leaders seeing the technology as, this is an example I give, is I think AI is the elevator of our time. It should allow us to fundamentally change the way that we work. And when the elevator was invented by Otis in the 1880s, engineers didn't get super excited that we can move faster from floor one to floor five. We thought, no, let's actually reimagine what cities look like. We began to build skyscrapers. This is our skyscraper moment for many organizations today. However, leaders are saying, no, this is great. I'm going to move floor one to five with less people. I'm going to move faster with less people. And this is so exciting. That's not what this moment is about. This moment is about building skyscrapers. And I do not see enough leaders focusing on that sort of use case for AI.
No. It's very interesting because every headline you read nowadays, you're right, you're absolutely correct. Companies have spent money on deploying AI with no benefits. I mean, there are many studies, McKinsey is one of them. They put out many studies out there where, you know, companies spend billions of dollars on deploying this supposed to be the magic wand of solving every ill they have. But meanwhile, they didn't do it. And now they're back to the drawing board trying to figure out, okay, what went wrong and how do we fix it? And I don't know if, you know, to some of these companies have... you know, have the train has left the station kind of thing, or back to the drawing board, back to investment. And how do they make the right decision at this point?
Yeah. You know, I think, first of all, the first thing is, I think leader, and this is not a popular message, I think we all need to slow down a bit in this pace of business. What I've seen is this addiction to this chaotic, frenetic way of doing business. And I think part of it was, again, part of the pandemic, we rewired how we were operating in our rhythms. And that made sense at the time because it was life and death. You cannot sustain this level of speed and perform well. It's just, this is not the way that leadership works. And so that is not popular because every leader I talk to says they're under pressure to move even faster, to find even more speed and acceleration next quarter. And so number one, which is a lot of the work I'm doing is...
Who's pressuring them? Is it the PE firm, the stock exchange? Who's pressuring them?
Yeah, it's investors by and large. Investors, it's board members. Yep. And it's because, and I think this is what we, again, why we've lost the plot. Business was used to be about slow, steady growth. And over time, and you look at the GEs, the IBMs, like the old school companies that have been around for a long time, it was constantly just slowly growing.
You build something for the future, not for 2-3 years.
Correct. And that is the time horizon is what we've lost sight of. Is I'm doing a study right now. I'm going to be fascinated. The companies that Wall Street right now is so obsessed with, will they even be around in 3 to 5 years? Like, where are going to be the next GEs coming out of this, you know, big digital transformation? And I worry, you know, and it shows up in the data. Like, let me give you a data point as an example. 70% of leaders today in North America actually think they're leaving their organization worse off than when they inherited their position.
That's scary, Kelly.
We've never seen that data. We've never seen such pessimistic
leaders,
sentiment. 70%
of them are leaving their organization worse than they took it on?
Correct.
That's crazy.
And they would say it's crazy. And they say it's because of all the macroeconomic headwinds. There's too much complexity. Some blame it on Gen Z. You know, there's all these like scapegoats that are out there. But I think the reality is leaders today have lost the plot of what work is all about. To me, what is the purpose of business? It's not shareholder wealth maximization. That is not the purpose. The purpose of business, I would rather have it to be to optimize returns to your shareholders, investors, optimize the way that you show up in your local communities, optimize the way that you treat employees. I think that is, if we begin to use the word optimization as opposed to maximization, we all automatically reframe the way that we're behaving and showing up as leaders.
I think we're going through, like, even leaders or PE firms or investors, it doesn't matter who they are. Yeah. I don't think we're setting the right expectations. I think we're we're going against, you know, every input or dynamics that's going around us and setting these lofty expectations. I don't think they're attainable. And thus people will face the realities.
Yes. And I'll tell you what, the two things. One, I think the hardest thing as a leader to do is to look at reality. Like, that is probably just the hardest thing to do. And that's like a lot of the workshops that I do with Beyond the Desk is how do we actually just look and name reality? Because we've done all this like corporate performative theater where we actually spent all this time and energy not looking at reality. And then number two is, I think a good reality check is Gen Z. Gen Z sees what's happening right now. And the more they're using AI, the less enamored they're getting with it. The more that they see this relentless pace, the more they're opting out of leadership and wanting to even climb the corporate ladder. 30% of Gen Zers, according to Gallup, actually want to be a leader today. Again, those numbers, we've never seen such low numbers. Usually at least 50% of a generational cohort wants to be, you know, in some sort of leadership position. Only 30%. Of Gen Zers. And not just that, about half of them say business is causing harm to society and they're kind of opting out. So to me, there's enough convergence happening that it'll be interesting to see. I think it's going to be very turbulent the next several years as we get through what AI actually really means for this moment. What are the returns? What does it mean to right size your workforce? But my personal opinion is you cannot continue to do mass layoffs. You cannot continue to disrupt local communities with data centers without enough backlash, where we have to reevaluate what is the sustainable path forward. And I don't think not enough people are asking that question right now.
You know, a few years ago, I was having a conversation with, you know, one of the, you know, big companies here in the country. I think it's one of the largest in the country. These guys, without naming any names, these guys, they probably control one third of the economy in Canada, probably. And I reported, you know, the company I used to work for used to report to the gentleman directly. And we used to meet every quarter for review financials like everybody else does.
Sure. Yeah.
And, you know, we always had this discussion, like, how long can you maintain in business that hockey stick graph that every CEO would dream about? You know, my business, you know, revenue, profitability are all going up in the same direction. And it basically, it's a hockey stick on a graph. And the answer is not forever. I mean, you got that jagged line and sort of like the momentum flatten out at some point. How many times do I hear that, you know, the CEO's job is to defend the company in front of the board? I mean, that's, they go in every quarter and they'd say, sorry, we didn't meet our target, but here's what we're doing. We're firing 15% of the responsible people. I don't know. I mean, is the CEO the responsible people or the other people are the responsible people at some point? Is leadership is the issue or the employees are the issue? What do you think?
Yeah, leadership has never been harder. So I say this with a lot of empathy, but leadership is the problem today. You can't blame people who don't have the power, who don't have the resources and don't have the decision-making within an organization. They are simply reacting. to a lot of what's happening up top. I also blame the board and investors. I mean, I think part of like the narrative before Milton Friedman declared shareholder wealth maximization in the 1970s as the moral responsibility of business, there was another way to do business. Like, it was not this relentless pursuit of profits at the expense of people. And so I think part of this is, you know, when we were getting there right before the pandemic in 2019, the business roundtables, which is associated with Davos and World Economic Forum, you had almost 200 CEOs sign a declaration that said, we will no longer pursue shareholder wealth maximization. We will seek, because of planet concerns, climate concerns, job, you know, employability concerns, we will pursue other pathways for business as the purpose. Pandemic hit and all that narrative went away. And I thought, we've got to resurface that and start knocking on those doors of those CEOs and say, where are we with this plan? Where are you with the balanced scorecard of how, to your point, when you're reviewing the P&L with your board, you should also be reviewing the impact you have on your people and planet. Where did that go? And that to me is, I think, really what the root problem is. We have bought into the wrong narrative. So as much, you know, and leaders have bought into that, which is why I blame leaders, but it's the narrative. That's the problem today.
You know, one of the culprit, in my opinion, and I don't want to dunk too much on them because they know that I don't like them that much, is private equity firms. Yeah. And, you know, PE firms, they go in, and there are many examples of successful company that they refuse to have anything to do with PE firms. Costco is one of them.
Where
they just don't want to have anything to do with PE firms. They're still healthy. They're still doing well. They're still expanding without the cycle of I own you for 2 years where I fix you up, 1 year to develop you, and 2 years to sell you. And that that entire five-year short-term cycle, it doesn't build businesses. It just builds a recycling machine of business.
I think. It does. I mean, I think that's the problem is PE firms often come in and sell for parts too as part of that recycled process. So what was a whole core business now tends to get isolated and separated for parts. And I guess the question becomes is, you know, what value is it actually putting back out into the economy? You know, and I think that is the question we're not asking enough about is, and 42%.
Level thinking, is that what you mean?
Yeah. I mean, what is the actual value? Again, you could say, hey, we made a short-term 13% turnaround profit, but longer term, what did you end up doing? Because you probably ended up laying off a lot of people. You probably ended up actually destroying a core value. Now, that's not to say when PE firms come in that oftentimes it's because the company has been mismanaged or that things have gone awry. But to your point, there has to be a better way to then reinfuse value as opposed to coming in, destroying it, and then selling it for parts.
Yeah, because the timeline of fixing, you know that you've spoken to so many leaders out there, the timeline of fixing a company cannot be on a clock, cannot be on a stopwatch.
Yeah.
And you know, to move forward with an initiative, for instance, you probably cannot put it on a calendar in terms of the larger picture. Of course, every project's got a deadline. I'm not arguing about that.
Sure.
But in a larger picture, for instance, to take a company from status A to status B, it may not be on a PE firm timeline. It could be on other timelines that needs to be moving forward. Now, you draw on the Denning's thinking that systems are the issue, not people. How does that play out in practice, like from a CEO perspective, when it comes down to say, well, my people aren't adapting, for instance? I've heard that many times, and I'm sure
you did. Yeah, people are always the problem from a CEO's perspective. I think what you just said, and you know, obviously Deming said it first, that a bad system will outperform a good person every time. And I think we're seeing that in spades right now. I think a CEO, and I think really leadership as a whole, even middle managers, have to begin to see themselves as stewards of a system. And I think there's not, you know, I've studied a lot of behavioral economics and change management. And so I think what oftentimes is a leader has a reality of, okay, we need to, like the famous words right now is better, faster, cheaper. Almost every leader today is asking their employees to move better, faster, cheaper. The problem is, they then don't remove the friction within the system to help actually enable that. And so employees continue to hit against friction and brick walls. And then leaders see that as not being able to adaptable or not working hard enough. When in reality is there's so much deep system work that has to take place and change and shift. And that's the job of the leaders is how do you actually facilitate the conditions so that the system adapts and changes? And then people are going to go to the path of least resistance, right? And so if you make the system move in such a way that people respond, your job is done. But I think we've skipped that hard system part change and try to change people. And it just is creating quite a paradox, I think, for many leaders today.
Now, you've used in your first book, you were just talking earlier about behavioral economics and management. And you made the case that most leadership decision making is based on assumptions about human behavior that are simply wrong.
Yep.
Was that the most dangerous one or there are others? Can you explain that one to the audience, by the way? It'd be good.
Yeah. So here, I mean, I've done so much employee engagement survey work. I could almost predict your employee engagement survey results if I were to survey your leadership team and ask them these two questions. One, do you think people inherently want to work? And that is just a yes or no. No gray. Like, do you think people inherently want to work? If there was universal basic income, do you think people would still opt into work? Two, do you trust your workforce to do the right thing on behalf of the organization? Those are the two assumptions. 50% of people answer those questions no, and they have terrible employee engagement scores. And that is because they come from a place of mistrust. They don't think people really want to work and don't want to be there anyways. And they think if given the choice, people are not going to make the right decision on behalf of the organization. That is how then we show up as leaders. And that's how we design all of our HR systems, is based on the 5 to 10% of the people where that may be true. I come from a different assumption and say that I think about 90% of the people find their meaning, identity, and reason for being through their profession. Majority of people do that. Majority of people also, when given the choice, do want to do the right thing for the organization. They're not trying to have these deviant behaviors. And so that's where I think leadership has fundamentally gone wrong, is we mistrust people. What would happen, and I'd love your audience to think about those two questions and how they would answer them themselves, but also if you did come from a position of trust, what would change in your HR policies? What would change in the way that you show up as a leader? And it's a domino effect. And I've seen this, you know, many times throughout organizations, when leaders are able to make that shift, most 9 out of 10 times their employees surprise them of how they actually show up and start running through brick walls.
100%. And you know what? I've managed people all my life. And I tell you, for those who are listening, used to work for me, you know that, you know what I'm talking about. Okay. I am not a helicopter manager. Like, I'm not hovering on top of people, like, asking them exactly where you are, what you're doing. And I manage remote workers. Like, they were not in the office. I was not sitting in a glass bowl somewhere watching everything they do. They're living in different cities, they're doing different things, but I trusted them enough to do the right thing for the company. And I always went by that gentleman that I just mentioned earlier without mentioning his name. He always told me, treat it like you own it. It's your company, it's your business. What would you do? What would you be doing if that was your company? And you know, you're absolutely correct. If we trust people, their trust is reciprocated. And if it's not a trust relationship, then guess what? It is not trust relationship. People will take advantage if you let them to, because you didn't trust them. I mean, how else are you going to do that?
That's right. And I think what you just said is so profound, because at the end of the day, I think what people, why we don't trust them is we don't make it safe for them to make mistakes in organizations, or make it safe for them to own the outcome or responsibility. And I think that is the dynamic equation here, is you have to trust people, and then you have to create the system in place so that people can have ownership of outcomes, that they can actually take that responsibility. And it's not built for everyone, right? Not everyone wants the responsibility. Some people do just want to come in and check a box and do a good job. You know, in HR, we call them study eddies. And those are the people that keep the lights on. But I think there's a lot more people that have a lot more to give. And we talk about underemployment within organizations. You know, this is a couple of years dated, but there was a time, an estimate that 33% of the workforce was underemployed, meaning they had a lot more to give, but kept showing up and was unable to give that for a variety of reasons. And to me, that is the job of leaders today, is how do you actually unlock that? And Great Place to Work has done some amazing research that they recently shared with me. High trust organizations, companies and leaders that trust their employees are getting 8.2 times more in revenue per employee within their organization. To me, like, trust equates to higher revenue. And I asked the researcher behind the study, I'm like, why is that? 8.2 times is a lot of revenue per employee. And she said it's because 90% of those employees were willing to go above and beyond for their leader. And that's what's missing today, is most employees are not willing to go above and beyond for the leader, because quite frankly, their leader probably doesn't deserve it in many ways, right? And I think that is, like, the true crisis of our time, is capturing the ability of people to bring their best every day.
And you use something called the seatbelt analogy. I'd love for you to dig into that a little bit for our audience, where you said paying people to comply produces short-term behavior that collapses, obviously, when the incentive goes away. Like, that system, that, you know, analogy, that system of paying people to produce something temporary, I don't know how you would sustain that as a business. Like, every time I need something to get done, I gotta put a new incentive out there? Or?
Yeah, exactly. Well, and the seatbelt example is so interesting. So just so your audience knows, the seatbelt example is, this is based on a real behavioral economics study where they wanted to incentivize a group of people to start wearing seatbelts. Now, that's the one group got money every time they wore a seatbelt. The other group, they appeal to them in terms of, hey, this is a safe thing to do for your family. This is good. Like, you're going to, you know, this is just overall a good thing to do. The people who believed it was a good thing to do wore their seatbelts long after the study was done. The people who were paid every time they were wearing a seatbelt, as soon as that payment was gone, unclick, no more wearing the seatbelt. And so we can train our brain. We have two sides, right? We're human nature. We are very extrinsically motivated. We're motivated by pay, but that is a very short-term lever. We're also very motivated by altruistic social well-being type reasons. And I don't think businesses are appealing to that enough.
Now, you know, I can't help but thinking, like, we're having all this conversation. Most businesses are driven by, because every business exists for a customer. If they don't have customers, they don't have business. Anybody can attest to that, right? It's not rocket science. Where is the customer in all this? Like, I mean, we're talking about the people. How do you, was there research on what is the customer seeing now? Are they liking what they're seeing? Are they buying into what they're seeing, or are they shying away from what they're seeing?
Yeah. You know, I think customer behavior is so fickle. I mean, as is probably any human behavior is. Well, here's what we are seeing in the research. Customers are putting a lot more pressure, I would say, on organizations to treat their people right, to not just deploy AI in all the customer service roles. And to your point, they're calling AI bots and everything like that. So customers have to continue to vote with their dollar more than anything else. And I think you've seen that some backlashes that have occurred more so for political reasons than necessarily AI reasons, but customers have to continue to vote with their feet and with their dollar. The problem is we also are really drawn to convenience. And so oftentimes we are buying from organizations that our values might not align with because it's convenient. And so I think that's going to be the challenge as the macroeconomic conditions erode and every dollar begins to count even more. You have to remember, coming out of the pandemic, people saved a lot of money. People were very cash rich coming out of the pandemic because they didn't go on vacations. They weren't buying new things, that sort of thing. Now, as the wallets get tighter, every dollar counts. And I think what we're going to see is customers choose to spend that where there's value alignments, where they feel good about spending that dollar. And yes, we're going to still see some convenience spending where there's going to maybe be some value misalignment. But at the end of the day, to me, it's about aligning with customers right now. And what do customers care about? They care about quality products. They care about usually people getting treated well, that sort of thing. And that, I think, is what's actually eroding in this moment with AI. And I think that's, like, again, the narrative leaders have to figure out is, how do you make sure you don't lose customer value as you begin to chase this AI hype cycle?
You know, I want to say a couple words on this one, because the customers are interacting with businesses. And, you know, when you see, you know, leaders reacting I want to say spontaneously to whatever pressure they're facing today. And I, you know, some leaders are faced with many, many pressures out there, investors, employees, etc. And the cuts that they're making or the changes that they're making is the impacting the layer where you are interacting with customers without properly measuring, without properly investigating that. I would have to say, I mean, it's kind of hit the top line revenue like crazy. I mean, I know you're trying to address as a leader how efficient your company is running to improve the bottom line. But if you don't have revenue, you can't have efficiency. I mean, efficiency has to come from something. It can't come from thin air.
100%. Yeah. And I think too many leaders today are trying to cut their way to growth. And that's, to your point, that's never been a good strategy. And I think, like, a good example too is self-checkouts at retail. If we think about that, we actually don't need a human at the checkout counter anymore. There's enough technology that we've figured that out. Most retailers got pretty bullish on self-checkout when it first came out. It was going to be efficient. They didn't have to pay employees to do that. Then what happened? There was too much friction in the customer experience. Customers didn't want to do it. They were, you know, mistakes were being made as they were trying to check out. It became filled with friction. So what happened? We immediately put the humans back in the loop. And I think, to your point, that's a good example of just because AI can or just because the technology can does not actually mean that that's going to equate to customer value. In some ways, it actually might equate to customer friction if not deployed appropriately.
Do you think we need a new generation of leaders? Do you think the legacy leaders can take us into the new millennium or in the new era?
That is a really good question. I want to answer it in a nuanced way. So I don't alienate your audience. I think it's going to be really hard for the legacy leaders to pick up the new playbook that's required. It is a complete rewrite of how they've been successful. I mean, AI is democratizing intelligence and expertise, and that is such a threat. Like, even to me as a researcher, you know, that's probably more mid-career, that's a threat. So do I think the existing generation of leaders is capable? Absolutely. Do I think it's going to be a much steeper hill for them to climb compared to, like, Gen Z as an example? Absolutely. And behind closed doors, what leaders tell me is, Kelly, I'm just trying to make it the next 3 to 5 years. Like, I want to make it to retirement. I've done the best I can. It's ready for the next generation to come in and start figuring some of this stuff out. And so I do think there's this, you know, baton that's ready to be passed. The problem is, I shared with you, 30% of Gen Zers want that baton. 70% don't. They're seeing, you know, kind of a building on fire and are being asked to run towards it. And so I think this baton passing between generations of leaders is so important. And what I also respect a lot about the existing generation of leaders that the next generation does not have is the implicit knowledge, is the social capital. There is no social capital exchange when you start giving it to AI. And so how do we make sure that we protect these relationships? How do we make sure that we protect a lot of that industry knowledge that will go away when that generation of leaders leaves? And that to me is that transition we've got to get right. And it's going to be tricky. And I think that to me is where the rubber meets the road, is how do we pass the baton in such a way that yes, the building feels on fire, and in many cases it is, but how do we make sure that we're taking care of every generation as they exit and as they actually come into the new leadership positions?
I don't know what your take on this one, but I believe that the economy in general, specifically in North America, is going through a huge transformation. And we are going to see a lot of companies go away and new company comes up. You know, it's like the old economy, the first, the new economy that AI is building. We are going to be transforming everything we do. Either if you're a legacy company, you got to make a decision. Am I going to be continue to be a legacy company? I got to move forward. You know, the old saying goes, you know, you can't teach it. You can't teach an old dog a new trick, or you can teach an old dog a new trick. Unfortunately, I'm not a pet owner, so I wouldn't know the difference. But if we are thinking, okay, we're going to take a leader who's been, you know, who is like in the 60s or 70s years old, or even 50 years old, and we're going to take that individual and going to put him in front of an entirely brand new culture from a people perspective, and we're going to put on top of them a brand new technology that we don't understand the capacity or the capability of what we're going to do in the future, and we're going to ask them, hey, lead us into the 22nd century. It's I think we're asking too much in this case. Mind you, many leaders are accidental leaders, happened to be at the right place, the right time, got promoted to be a leader, never got the proper tooling, the proper training, the proper evaluation. Hey, you know, you've been at this job for many years. I think the CEO is leaving. Your turn now. Just get in and take that position. I don't know. I mean, it feels like it's a many items going on here that they're contributing to where we are right now.
I think that's spot on. And, you know, one of my favorite statements is by Meg Wheatley, who's an organizational behaviorist as well. And she said, whenever there's a problem, community is the answer. And I think you're absolutely right. This moment, in this transitional moment that we're in, which is to your point, is we're entering into a new value creation of how the economy works. We're moving into, I think most likely small business is going to actually outperform large businesses because the economics with AI no longer makes sense to have these mammoth companies because of all of this. So you've got this just huge foundational changes at the economic level, generational level, that sort of thing. And to me, this is the time where we actually need to be less competitive and more collaborative and community-based across our industries of what's working, how do we get through this? And that's what I worry I don't see enough of, is a lot of that peer exchange, that peer learning, that really being able to share insider baseball, if you will, of here's how AI is working, or here's how it's not working, here's what I'm struggling with. And I think that's what we actually need to see more of, is how do you actually provide leaders with community right now so we can make this transition? And by the way, that community also needs to include young people and a better understanding of what's happening. And again, if it's too much, I think this is also a perfect time to start passing the baton. I know there's a whole bunch of Gen Xers who've been waiting for a while to start getting into those seats. And so I think part of this is also making sure that you're passing the baton when ready.
Now, we've talked about, you know, the idea of, you know, AI is not solely the efficiency fuel for many things. I mean, we're talking about the service industry in general here. You know, if you're in a manufacturing industry, or you're in resource industry, oil, mining, etc., that's a bit of a distance for you, but more in the knowledge-based industry, this is a huge impact in any company in the knowledge-based industry. And so in the room full of leaders who are being told, you know, implement AI, do more with less, and, you know, and they're being pressured by the investors, etc., and you're in conversation with these individuals, and you're telling them what you're telling me right now. How are they reacting to this? And is this message going to the investors? Are the investors aware of this? Like I get involved a lot of times. People, you know, like in the investment community, they call me up and say, Robin, you know, we're considering buying this company, or considering investing in this field. What do you think? And I'm surprised in a lot of cases, like you're investing in a lot of cases, they're putting their investment in an old technology, and their only hope is to introduce AI to the equation after the investment to make their money and move away from that. And I'm thinking there's many of those scenarios that are still around.
Yeah. I mean, that's a great question. I mean, right now, and in some ways, leaders, you know, how do they respond as we're having this kind of conversation? They actually is like a wave of relief. Because I think intuitively, if you've been a leader for the last 20, 30 years, you know we're not doing this right in many cases. You know, to your point, the job has gotten too hard. There's too much complexity. There's too much pressure. Like you're being asked to do the impossible. So one, I think there's actually a sense of relief of, thank God I now have the language framework and research to start comprehending what's happening around me. The second thing though is it's a great behavior change intention. And I think actually what leaders need today is even more courage and conviction to do the right thing. Leadership has not changed. What makes great leaders has not changed just because AI has come onto the stage. Leaders have gotten distracted though and started chasing a hype cycle. Do I think every company needs to become AI enabled? In most cases, yes. I think AI has a lot of promise to a lot of great things. Does every company, though, become an AI company? No, most companies are not going to be an AI company. And I think the challenge is, and I was just actually talking to an investor a couple of weeks ago, and this alarmed me a bit. He was getting ready to exit his investment. And I said, he kind of had like a sour face, you know, as he was describing it. And I said, well, what's going on? He's like, well, we got a 2.5x return. You know, I'm pretty disappointed. I said, in a matter of 2 to 3 years, you 2.5x your investment. What's the problem? You know, we really wanted 4 to 6, 8 times. I'm like, in 2 to 3 years, like what would have changed? Like, this is not a unicorn. There's only so many unicorn companies out there that you're going to get that level of investment. And I think that's the problem is investors all have this tech idea of like, oh, this is going to be an AI moment. We're going to get 10x our investment in 2 years. That is not reality for 9 out of 10 companies today. And I think that is the concern. Expectations. Right? 1,000%. When did 2.5x in 2 years become such a disappointment? That to me is my question to the investor community.
And you know, it all started when the pandemic hit and people went working remotely and companies started flashing huge financial statements, positive financial statements because of the cost, lowering the cost on real estate, on IT support, on many functions. And you know, the investors got used to that. They said, oh, you've done it here. You should be able to do it next year. So the following year, they started working on other mechanisms. AI, it was one of them, and setting that expectation falsely at the start. If anybody out there listening to this and you're expecting 10x on your investment from AI, you know, tell me what drugs you're on. I'd love to be part of that party. No, it's very interesting. Our industry that I do podcasts on, I worked on most of my time is the localization industry, which built on a freelance community. Yeah. And you worked in the freelance community of Upwork. Your research in Upwork on AI empowering freelancers, and that's what we talk about in the industry, using AI as a tool to make you the army of one, to make you multiply your output in a better way, in a more positive way, not to replace you, but to make you do more. What would that look like as an intentional strategy for leaders? Not necessarily, take it away, you know, because every business is working with freelancers, everybody's working with contractors, temporary workers, or full-time employees for that matter. And what would they need to do differently to make that real for their individual users?
Yeah. Well, I think it's great to use translation and localization as a use case. So when I was at Upwork, I started the Upwork Research Institute, and actually translation localization was one of the most disrupted categories early on from AI.
We scream a lot in our industry.
Yeah. And investors, you know, were all over Upwork at the time, and I'm sure still are, of AI is going to eat this category. Like, you're not going to need localization and translators anymore. Like, AI can do all of that. And so we developed a longitudinal study to see how was AI actually disrupting this offering. It was fascinating. So what you saw is like early AI came on the board and you did see a downward slope for localization and translation as a category of work in need of freelancers. But then all of a sudden you started to see this rebound about 2 years later after using the tools. And here's how it rebounded. It rebounded where actually the work itself became more complex and humans were actually getting paid more to do that work. And so that to me, when you ask like, what's the intentional strategy here is how do you move humans up the higher value chain so that you're getting more complex translation, that you're getting more nuanced localization. AI does not know everything. It actually makes quite a bit of errors when it is doing translation as an example. And there's so much nuance, like as a local cultural, I was just in Korea as an example, there is really word for word is not where the magic happens. What happens is when you understand the nuance and you need something else to be spoken or something else to be said, or you understand that that translation actually does not translate well, or worst case scenario is offensive. AI doesn't know all of that. And so that to me is kind of going to be the interesting thing to continue to watch is AI can do the transactional, what we call lower value, less complex work. And if you're a freelancer doing that today, our whole thing at Upwork was to move up the value chain. And this is the time to move up the value chain. So that's the intentional point here is how do you use AI to gain efficiency and lower value work and move humans up the higher value chain? because everyone wins. People end up making money. Now, I'm not going to lie to your community. Do you need as many people doing translation work? Maybe not. That pool of human labor might begin to shrink a bit, but the pay, the pot within that is even higher. And so that to me is a little bit of a race within the freelancer community is how do you stay ahead? And those that are using AI to do this work are the ones that are actually winning at the end of the day.
You know, it's very interesting because the amount of content that we're seeing generated, not amount of content being transformed, meaning translation or sure. adaptation, etc. Yeah. But AI has opened the floodgate for content yeah. to be generated. And one thing for sure is as people are using AI daily for a variety of things, if you are an expert at a certain topic and you're able to judge the output, it puts you in a good position. Yeah. Translator, architect, sorry. Programmers, etc. If you're not,
yep.
let's say you're not a programmer, you don't understand the logic of programming, and you go to Vibe Coding and Codex or one of those yep. tools and you start writing programs. Yeah, it works. But if you're not a programmer, how do you judge that this is not, for instance, opening a big security vulnerability on your system, for instance? How do you, if you don't understand Korean and you're trying to translate to Korean and AI yep. produces something in Korean, how do we know that this Korean is good, yep. not offensive? You're not going to insult anybody. The problem with AI is people are taking it for granted the way it's outputted and must sure. be true because AI produced it. And in fact, if you're not putting a second set of eyes on whatever you're doing, an architectural diagram, a translation, whatever you're doing, you are opening yourself to a lot of vulnerability on a variety of scales. Yeah. One, security, credential, people trust you, don't trust you. Those kinds of things are very, very interesting now. And you're right. The human value gets elevated because this is yeah. where it's going to shine now. And we may
yes,
see
that that's right.
in saying work has dried up a little bit, but it may come back up. It will come back up because we're going to realize it's not ready for prime time yet.
Absolutely. And I think what you just said too is part of why humans are coming back is there's so much quantity that's out there now. And so, you know, you've seen the term AI slop. There's a lot of AI slop out there. And unless you have the domain expertise, you can't fix it, right? Like, it takes domain expertise to actually solve AI slop. And I think AI slop doesn't occur if you're an expert, right? Like you, to your point, you can judge the outcome. So that's why, to your point, humans are going to be around for a long time because as quantity of AI slop goes up, human value goes up as well.
No, your book Essential, and I realize for the time here, I would love to talk to you more, but
yeah,
this conversation is going very well. Yeah. I'd love to continue this conversation. But your book Essential landed as a national yeah. bestseller.
If
I'm reading this correctly. What is the yeah. one idea that the book you think leaders are most resistant of, even though they know it's true, but they're still resisting it?
You know, we have a very simple premise or hypothesis or argument in the book. That's the core narrative, which is if you put people first, profits will follow. And the whole narrative is around how do you actually put people first as AI is starting to compete for human jobs in many ways. So that's like the core premise. And I think leaders read it and intuitively are shaking their head. But when they get to the last chapter, what Christy and I developed was this model, which is how do you actually get the flywheel of leadership going so people are first in a way that profits follow? And the very first thing is suspend self-interest. And that's yeah. probably the hardest where leaders get stuck is, well, Kelly, you know, this is job and the weight of the world is on my shoulders. No one else is carrying the weight of the responsibility I have. And, you know, I've got all XYZ going on. Suspending self-interest and trusting the people that you are there to actually serve your customers, serve your people, not just the shareholders, not just to make a profit is probably the hardest mindset shift right now because the voice of the investor is so loud. The voice of the board is so loud that it's actually drowning out what we argue is actual core purpose of leadership, which is to cultivate a people first approach within your organization so that system works, so that people are ready.